Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. The issue of national security is constantly invoked by politicians and the media as justifications for war and surveillance. Since the September 11th attacks, the U.S. has launched endless wars that have ironically made us less safe and built an unprecedented network of intrusive surveillance. Today, as part of an ongoing series of interviews that I did with a number of experts, journalists, authors, and academics, we'll explore what the U.S.'s national security policies have really amounted to. The interviews were produced by Brave New Films, headed by the acclaimed filmmaker Robert Greenwald, and they're called the Henry A. Wallace National Security Forum. Henry A. Wallace was the 33rd Vice President of the United States and served under Franklin Delano Roosevelt during World War II. He ran for the presidency on the Progressive Party ticket in 1948 and was an agriculturalist, economist, author, and businessman, and was known as the champion of the common man in the struggle against moneyed elites for control of government and the planet's resources. Well, on today's episode of the Henry A. Wallace National Security Forum, we present my interview with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz on how U.S. imperialism began right here at home. Ms. Dunbar-Ortiz is an American Indian activist and scholar. She's the author of a number of books, including The Great Sioux Nation, An Oral History of the Sioux Nation and Its Struggle for Sovereignty, Roots of Resistance, A History of Land Tenure in New Mexico, 1680 to 1980, Indians of the Americas, Human Rights and Self-Determination, Blood on the Border, Memoir of the Contra War, and Outlaw Woman, A Memoir of the War Years, which was first published in 2002. And her latest book is An Indigenous People's History of the United States, which is now out in paperback. The United States' history of usurping lands and dominating the local population began right here at home with our treatment of Indigenous Americans. How does the U.S. use those same tactics overseas? Welcome to the Henry A. Wallace National Security Forum. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. From the early European colonies in the 15th and 16th centuries, all the way up to the Indian Wars in the late 1800s, the U.S. routinely invaded and occupied lands held by indigenous peoples, exploiting natural resources, removing them from the land, and violating peace treaties. How has that history shaped the way the U.S. interacts with the rest of the world? Joining me to answer that question is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, former professor and author of An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Welcome to the program, Roxanne.
Thank you.
Let's begin with taking a look at the history of the United States and how it differs when examining it through the lens of Indigenous Americans versus the mainstream.
Well, it's very different because with a colonial settler state, there's a tendency toward eliminationism, and it's a really pernicious form because it doesn't really want the native people for labor as the Spanish did, or for trade as the French did, but actually for them to disappear so they can bring settlers. And then land itself becomes the main commodity for capital accumulation.
Does the U.S. today use the same reasoning that it did with the settler colonialist project aimed at indigenous Americans? Does it use that same reasoning in current foreign interventions?
Yes, it's sort of the institutionalized, this way of warfare, which is counterinsurgency, using settlers on their own, a kind of settler democracy, fighting for that land. And they then form armies, you know, once the United States is independent, based on counterinsurgency, the army as a backup for the settlers to take land. So those were the only wars occurring were wars against the native people up until the Civil War. So the imperialist urge was there from the beginning, and it got institutionalized. It's the core makeup of the U.S. Army today, and in almost every situation, as they did in the Philippines and in Cuba, when the people were revolting for independence and co-opting that independence and then crushing it and occupying those places. So that has continued, and we see it being played out every day today.
Now, does the U.S. use a similar legal basis for its current wars as it did for occupying the majority of the U.S., a country that was already settled by indigenous Americans? Is the legal basis similar?
what we've seen playing out in the last 15 years or so is, and a little bit before that, is the concept of homo sacer, which was also a part of the doctrine of discovery, and that is those people who are resist colonization or resist intervention are, well, now we call them terrorists, but homo sacer is a person without any rights. So we had the unlawful combatants, and in several decisions in the 19th century of the U.S. Supreme Court, Native people who resisted the Seminole Wars and the Modoc Wars, they actually found that they had no rights, that they were unlawful combatants. And those cases have actually been used in the military tribunals for the Guantanamo incarcerated.
So Roxanne, let's talk about the way in which the doctrine of our military today, the sort of culture and the rules that inform the U.S. military today, are informed by the history of U.S. settler colonialism.
Well, because this army formed from popular militias that used counterinsurgency to take territory, take the land, they attack the people, the civilians on it, and often the most vulnerable of those people, because Native people did come to form incredible guerrilla warfare. Was the first guerrilla warfares were in the Americas fighting colonialism. And the Army has traditionally studied this warfare and implemented it and documented it. I know Rand Corporation had the defense contract with the Department of Defense during the Vietnam War to develop counterinsurgency strategy. They were studying the wars with the Apaches, with the Lakota, the Seminole Wars, the Modoc Wars, and that these people were the Vietnamese, the Indians were the Vietnamese. So they even call enemy territory Indian country. So wherever they go, it's Indian country. Iraq was Indian country, Afghanistan, Vietnam was Indian country.
I want to talk a little bit about what American Indians and indigenous communities today are experiencing. First, what sort of autonomy do they enjoy, given that supposedly they live in sovereign nations? And second, what forms of resistance to historical settler colonialism are taking place even today among Native Americans and indigenous communities in the U.S.?
The British had the tradition of making treaties where they conquered people. But in actual law, the doctrine of discovery, the definition of Native people as domestic dependent nations without any inherent rights, that those reservations are not the property, the collective property of Native Americans, but are a gift from the federal government, a grant that can be taken away. So it's a very, very precarious position that Native people have, a very weak position. And with their numbers small, you know, it's very hard to fight, especially since the Industrial Revolution, the big powerhouse of the corporations.
Well, finally, Roxanne, I'm glad you brought up this issue of how Native peoples are fighting corporate domination. And I'm wondering if we can end on this question. And we see today, for example, Native communities in South America and Latin America and Brazil and the Amazon fighting off the encroachment of a corporate power and corporate takeover of their lands. And in many ways, it seems as though the U.S. relationship to indigenous communities has been rooted in corporate takeovers as well. So I'm wondering if you can end on, or if you can expand a little bit on that project and how the project of imperialism and colonialism is intertwined with the project of corporate domination, particularly aimed at indigenous communities.
So it's my view that the United States was an unusual entity to form as a nation state, that it was the first pure capitalist state to exist, that it was formed as a corporation, as a corporate body based on 200 years of corporate investments, that every colonizing venture from the British in those 200 years were done by private companies, from the very first one in Jamestown with investors, with mercenaries along to run the show, and also with the programs that are celebrated at Thanksgiving, and of course the trade in African bodies as well, and land sales. So this built the capital accumulation of the United States that allowed it to go into the Industrial Revolution very early, and by the 1880s be the leading economic power in the world.
Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali.
On the next episode of the Henry A. Wallace National Security Forum, author Anand Gopal talks to us about U.S. invasion from the perspective of the people whose country we've invaded.
If the U.S. was genuinely interested in averting humanitarian crises, then it would cut its support for these elements in the Iraqi security forces and the Shia militias, who are doing things that are just as bad as ISIS and other groups.
And Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz is an American Indian activist and scholar. Her latest book is An Indigenous People's History of the United States, just out in paperback. And my interview with her is part of the Henry A. Wallace National Security Forum presented by Brave New Films. On next week's program on Tuesday, we'll play an interview with journalist Anand Gopal on the war in Afghanistan. This is Uprising. After this break, Max Blumenthal joins us. Stay tuned.